Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. An active area in that battle space at the moment continues to be, amazingly enough, almost a year after it was precipitated, the story as yet untold about what actually went on the night of September 11th, 2012, when a special mission compound and a CIA annex were attacked in Benghazi. One of the people who has been leading the effort to try to find out what actually happened that evening, and most especially why a rescue mission was not mounted to save the lives of perhaps the four individuals who were killed, including Ambassador Christopher Stevens, the others who were at risk, when the need for such a rescue mission was pretty clear, is our first guest. He is Colonel Richard, also known as Dick Brower, United States Air Force retired, a man with a very distinguished background and record in the special operations component of the Air Force, including serving as the commandant of Special Operations School at Herbert Field. He is a member of the Hall of Fame, I might add, of the Air Commandos, and a great guest. We're delighted to have you back. Colonel, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Frank.
First of all, tell us just a little bit about Special Operations Speaks, the organization that you helped pull together, and why you did so, sir.
Sure. We're over a year old now, and we were formed on the 5th of June, and basically our first mantra, our first war cry, was that we were very much disturbed about the egregious leaks of classified information. So very much related to the NDA, the non-disclosure agreement issues that are currently under scrutiny right now. But immediately after the Osama bin Laden takedown, details of the operation that endangered future special ops as well as families of the SEAL teams were revealed. That really, we're telling our enemy exactly as in the NSA business right now, what we do, how we do it, and how to prepare to counter what we do. And so Larry Bailey, a former SEAL captain and co-founder, friend of mine, called me and said, we have to do something to expose the leaks that are coming out. So we actually started pre-election in June of 2012, discussing the leaks and why these are so dangerous, movies being made, leaks immediately after the raid, books being written, and you put all that together and you wind up with classified information. And pretty soon we found out that we had a lot more to deal with than just that. And if you go to our website, www.specialoperationsspeaks.com, there's a little 3-minute video that kind of says it all. It's called Leaks, Lies, Libya, and Lack of Leadership. All of those themes are as germane today as they were on June 5th, 2012. So that's how we started Special Operations Speaks. We're all volunteers, unpaid. We have some political advisors and a lawyer. You have to have a lawyer.
You have to have a lawyer. That's right.
You have to have a lawyer. And we're a super PAC, and we depend on contributions from citizen patriots and people that back what we are doing. And we have been focused, very, very focused, despite all the scandals du jour of the day on Benghazi, because this is a puzzle that has not been put together. As you say, we're within 7 weeks of the anniversary, seven weeks about that. And we are very much concerned with what's going on. And we are delighted that Congress has responded to the letter that we put together on the 8th and launched to the House of Representatives on the 8th of April, essentially saying there's too many lies going on, and we need to know what really happened at Benghazi, and most particularly, why no special ops forces that have trained and bled for rescue events such as this was not mounted. I lost five friends on Desert One on the 24th of April, 1979. But as Jim Kyle, a close friend and one of the commanders, said, we had the guts to try. We had the guts to try. And in this case, our administration not only did not have the guts to try, though we had resources available, but they, for political reasons, pre-election, Al-Qaeda is gone, Arab Spring, all of the things we all know about, we never allowed our special operations troops to do what they'd been trained to do and were probably champing at the bit to do, and that was to launch a combined attack, possibly with some conventional forces, such as fighters out of Aviano, Italy. That can be done. We have a lieutenant general that is with us that used to fly those. He was the vice chief of staff of the Air Force, Lieutenant General Tom McInerney, known to many on Fox.
Indeed. Let me interrupt just for a second because I want to reintroduce our guest. He is Colonel Richard, or Dick Brower, and a man who has, as he's been mentioning, been a leading force behind this terrific organization, Special Operations Speaks. And Dick, let me just ask you to sort of drill down on this series of questions that clearly continue to need answers. You've mentioned one, the fact that there was no rescue operation mounted, despite the fact that we had the capabilities to do so. One of the leaders of this effort in Congress to try to get to the bottom of all of these questions is our friend Congressman Frank Wolf. In fact, my representative in the House, he is. Had a series of questions this week. In fact, he's going to be doing one per day, I think, between now and the anniversary, that indicate the sorts of as yet unaddressed, unexplained, and in need of clarification topics that that cry out for a select committee of the Congress to get to the bottom of these issues at long last. That was the thrust of this letter that you've mentioned. Some 700 of your comrades in arms, former special operations members, now up to something approaching 1,000, I'm told. This really cries out for the kind of clarity that has yet to be provided. Tell me what you plan to do this week, I guess Tuesday at noon, to intensify the pressure on behalf of the special operators and others in uniform, and for that matter, the rest of us, to find out finally the truth behind Benghazi Gate.
Right. Basically, what we called for in our original letter was for the House to appoint a select committee, very similar to Watergate, though no one died in Watergate, with subpoena power being absolutely critical to this, to be able to break into these the folks that have been required to sign non-disclosure agreements. I know that Congressman Wolf is going to concentrate on the security aspects, the fact that we had providing security for the special mission compound, as it's been referred to. It's not a consulate. It wasn't a consulate. That we had put the Fox in charge of the hen house, and I believe the unit is called the February 17th Martyrs Brigade, providing security there on that evening, and also bugging out when they should have came to our assistance. And also, I know that he believes, as I do, that this group was probably responsible for scoping out the layout and disposition of our people in the embassy. We know that somebody early in the morning, before the evening of the attacks that lasted almost 8 hours, was photographing that particular facility. So they were scoping this in. Those mortars that were fired that killed our SEALs, there were 6 rounds fired, 4 of them dead on target. That tells me somebody had had it sighted in, as you would with a very heavy weapon like an 81-millimeter mortar. So Frank Wolf will be there attending. I think he'll be speaking our event on the Capitol steps, on the ceremonial steps, I believe they call it, at 12 noon on Tuesday the 23rd. And we plan to roll a very large scroll. It's never been done before, 4 feet wide, 60 feet long, with this very letter that kind of lit the fuse on trying to get House Resolution 36 in being. And to date, as Frank Wolf announced yesterday, we have 161 signatures on it. We need about 216 or 218 to have that going to
discharged.
Effect.
Discharged, indeed. Colonel Dick Brower, I'm afraid we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for what you do at Special Operations Speaks. We'll look forward to a terrific event on Tuesday and to calling more attention to the need for action to find out what indeed happened in the course of Benghazi Gate and how to avoid it ever happening again. Next up, Mark Langfan joins us to talk about the Palestinians' poisoning of Israel's water supply. Straight ahead.
You think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. For over 7 months, the truth has been hidden about a terrorist attack that killed 4 Americans in Benghazi, Libya, last September 11th. We still don't know why our ambassador was in that dangerous place on a day Islamists have made dangerous for all of us, or why we were repeatedly told that a mob, not jihadist, killed him and his comrades, or why no effective rescue effort was mounted. So 700 of my fellow Special Forces veterans who have participated in such efforts in the past have teamed up to learn the truth and to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. To see a copy of our open letter to House Speaker John Boehner calling for a real investigation of Benghazi Gate and to urge your representative to do the same, go to www.inthecoverup.com, a project of the Center for Security Policy. Thank you.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Mark Langfan. He is a businessman, a real estate attorney by trade, but I think better known to most of us in the national security space as the Map Man. Mark Langfan is the guy who has helped educate innumerable numbers of both public policy practitioners, politicians, and others interested in our national security, and for that matter, that of the State of Israel, through a topographical map that he has developed and really shown with tremendous effect is a teaching tool. Mark, it's great to have you back with us at Secure Freedom Radio. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Frank. As always, you are just one in a billion.
Well, thank you. Listen, there's a quick question that I just want to set the stage with. We've been told that John Kerry, the Secretary of State, has effected a breakthrough that will result in new negotiations getting underway with the Palestinians and the Israelis here shortly. Is there any likelihood that this will actually translate into a breakthrough in terms of peace for Israel?
Well, I think it's a breakthrough in terms of war, in that I believe there has been some type of movement by the Israelis to accept some type of 67 borders terms of reference in the peace talks, whether it's through a letter sent to the Israelis from America, which the Israelis passively accept as their invitation to the talks, or something. But the thing that has me very concerned is the total failure of Prime Minister Netanyahu, to specifically say that he is not and has not agreed to the 67 terms of reference.
Mark Langfin is our guest. You were talking about Bibi Netanyahu's failure to reject this terms of reference, if that's what it is, for these new negotiations. A number of his cabinet members and other senior figures in his coalition government have expressly disavowed this. Mark, do you think that the prime minister is actually party to this idea, or he has simply allowed it to happen in the spirit of sort of, well, let's see what happens if the Palestinians are made that offer and then, as usual, walk away from it?
Well, whether it's a passive party or an active party, it certainly seems to me that there is some type of sub rosa, unannounced, quiet acquiescence to the 67 borders by Netanyahu.
Okay, why would this be such a bad idea based upon the analysis that you've done with your topographical map, Mark Langfein?
Well, the 67 borders are, in essence, death borders for Israel. So if you come from the perspective that you want Israel to survive, which I am from, in that I believe Israel is a vital strategic asset for the United States and is actually the anchor of stability for the United States in the Middle East, then putting Israel into 67 borders is almost akin to creating five superhighways between France and England during World War II.
What we would see, if I may, is the high ground, which your topographical map makes clear would be in the hands of Israel's enemies, being available to them for strategic attacks against the Jewish population, which would be nestled in a very small confined space by the coast. And Mark, this is a problem that you've documented, can be executed through attacks of various kinds, missiles, rockets, and the like. But you've also pointed out recently something that, frankly, I don't think many of us had ever heard of or thought about before. Talk about the aquifers that Israel relies upon in that desert part of the world and how they could be used, in fact, perhaps are being used by the Palestinians, literally poisoning the well.
Well, this is once you understand that the West Bank was really misnamed, in that it should have been named the West Heights, in that the West Bank is not a salient down, sort of like a little, like it is actually a salient above you where water hits. It's almost like a roof of a house where the West Bank is the roof and the coastal plain is this gutter. And so water hits the West Bank, and fresh water actually hits the West Bank and is responsible for about 50 to 60% of Israel's water supply. But apart from that, fresh water comes downhill, but also refuse water from the Palestinians, that they fail to properly treat their sewage, also comes downhill. And I've named it Jihad by Toilet, where about 50 million cubic meters a year of Palestinian refuse sewage water is 50 million cubic meters. Of that, only 5 million cubic meters are quote-unquote treated, and people believe even that isn't properly treated. And that gets thrown into the aquifers, and aquifers are like sponges in that it is a huge underground sponge where the water courses through these aquifers, and because of the topography, the aquifers are, if you imagine an above-ground stream, an aquifer is like an underground stream.
Right. Now, Mark, let me just ask you, because we're going to run out of time here. I just want to be clear. The poisoning of these aquifers, which is the practical effect of what the Palestinians are doing, is not because the Palestinians have not understood that you should treat this refuse water or even been offered the means by which to do it. Is that right? This is a deliberate policy that they've taken.
It is a deliberate policy, but it's worse than that. America has actually given the Palestinians millions of dollars from our tax money to build water sewage treatment plants that instead of building the water sewage treatment plants, the money goes into Abbas's or whatever is the latest thief du jour from the Palestinian Authority.
The kleptocrats. All right, now, Mark, quickly,
exactly.
The critical piece of this, which you've introduced in your essay at Arutz Sheva,
polio.
Yeah, is about something that is in particular contaminating this water. Go ahead.
Yes, it was discovered in early June that throughout the coastal plain of Israel, exactly where this refuse water would be hitting pre-67 Israel, it was discovered polio, active wild polio, and people have to be very careful if they're going to Israel that they have to drink bottled water, and there's all different problems with respect to children, young children going to Israel. Because the polio that was discovered in these aquifers is live and could potentially actually give a person polio.
We got to wrap this up. Mark Langfan is our guest. He is the map man. He has helped us understand the aquifers that supply Israel's vital water that draw from fresh water coming down off of the heights of the West Bank. And polio is now contaminating that water supply as a deliberate and direct result of what the Palestinians are doing. This does not bode well for a peace process, needless to say. Mark, come back to us again very soon with updates on this, please. It's a critically important story, and we appreciate very much your help to break it here.
And God bless you, Frank, for all your great effort.
Next up, we'll be getting an undiplomatic critique of President Obama's 2009 Islamist outreach speech. Straight ahead.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Secretary of State John Kerry has bullied Israel into making further concessions to its Palestinian enemies. In exchange for the Palestinians' agreement in principle to resume peace negotiations, the Israelis will release more convicted terrorists. If the Jewish state pays this price, it must expect the same results as before. More hardened criminals unleashed to wage jihad against Israel and against any Palestinians that might actually wish to make peace with her. For that reason, among many others, there will be no real progress towards a genuine peace, and inevitably pressure will begin to mount all over again for further Israeli concessions. The United States' interest is in a strong and secure Israel. John Kerry's egotistical pursuit of negotiations that cannot produce this result must be halted before even more harm is done. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them.
When you make fun of them.
When you wave your finger and scold them.
I don't think you turn anybody around.
And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
We're back, joined by Ambassador Charles Crawford of the United Kingdom. He's served for many years with distinction as a diplomat in its Foreign and Commonwealth Office, including tours as Her Majesty's Ambassador in Sarajevo, in Belgrade, and in Warsaw. He was also a political counselor for 3 years in Moscow during the very interesting and tumultuous times of the transition from the Soviet Union to Russia and what came next. He caught our eye because he wrote a very interesting and, I must say, especially for a diplomat, rather provocative piece about President Obama's 2009 speech, the first Muslim outreach speech that he gave in Cairo. It is a critique that's interesting in many respects, not least because as a former speechwriter himself, the ambassador brings to it the awareness of how one says things. And in this case is fairly sharply critical, as I say, of how President Obama said what he said and what he said. So, Mr. Ambassador, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's visit a little bit about this speech. It, of course, was regarded as one of the most important of the first Obama presidency. It meant a break from the Bush years and an opening to the Muslim world. What is it that he said that troubled you most? And what bearing does it have, as you see it, on what he's doing today?
Well, I think the big problem we have in the world, frankly, is that after the end of communism, where we in the West had spent a lot of time, you know, engaging with the Soviet Union, the former Eastern European countries, and in a sense, you know, sponsoring reform agendas of different shapes and sizes, solidarity in Poland, and so on, a strategic mistake was made not to launch a similar process for the National Socialist Cold War regimes across the Middle East. Some of which were more socialist than nationalist, some of which were more, you know, nationalist, religious than socialist. But fundamentally, that whole space was largely unreformed and unmodernized in any sense that we'd recognize it. So the speech in Cairo was coming to this after sort of, well, after 15 years of messing around in a rather inconsequential and not altogether happy way, trying to make up for lost time. So I suppose my main concern was that the message it sent was rather ambiguous about where America stands in support of authentic reform, change, liberalization, modernization in the Middle East as a whole. I think it obviously wanted to put some space between himself and what you might call the, you know, very forward George Bush approach to all this. But he seemed to me to fall back to a rather messy, uncertain, tentative general approach, which has led to the sort of, I would have said, to the sort of mess the U.S. policy is now in Cairo.
One of the things that is an attribute of that mess, of course, and I think was very much in evidence at the speech, was his desire to engage the Muslim Brotherhood. Specifically, he insisted that they be represented in that speech, to the great consternation of his host government. I'm wondering what you make of that specific initiative, Ambassador Crawford. Did you read into the speech more of a sort of an affinity for this Islamist impulse to the great detriment of women and minorities and other communities that really wasn't just a muddle? It was aligning with very bad folks.
Well, I think there was a sense in the speech, it's pretty clear, that what he wanted to say was, look, we are not here to change you, and we are here to accept you pretty much as you are, and let's talk. I suppose that was the underlying message. But the trouble with that is that by putting it in those terms, you end up, and by accepting the Middle East as it is, and by accepting people like the Muslim Brotherhood as they are, and they're certainly popular enough in certain quarters, by doing that, you somehow create a strange sort of relativism that really everyone is pretty much the same in all sorts of things other than maybe Al-Qaeda, and all we have to do is get along. You know, I'm always reminded of that famous speech in Mars Attacks when the president says to the Martians, why can't we all just get along? And the Martian sort of looks at him and spears him in the end. And this was a sort of message, why can't we all just get along? And there are, in fact, very specific reasons why we just all can't get along. And those weren't included in the speech. There was some quite, you know, strong stuff about Israel and Palestine, which most people, I think, including the audience, probably were rather more pro-Israeli than they were expecting. But the overall message, I think, was somehow, look, I'm not Bush, let's just all be nice to each other. And the trouble with not being Bush, you have to position yourself in favor of something as opposed to a sort of slightly soggy absence of things.
We're speaking with Ambassador Charles Crawford, a retired ambassador of the United Kingdom. He is speaking with us about a marvelous piece that he wrote entitled That Obama 2009 Cairo Speech in Retrospect. It appeared initially at Pundit Wire in the United Kingdom back in July 8th and was picked up by Newsmax here in the United States and it came to our attention. And one of the things that I particularly was interested in, Mr. Ambassador, were some rather strong words that you had for him about this women part of the equation. The passages you've described from his speech about women were ranging from dismal to feeble and maybe even disgraceful. Talk a little bit about your perspective on that and how it could well have contributed to, as I say, not just a muddle, but a very bad outcome with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt.
Well, the problem with women in Egypt, if I can put it this way, is this horrendous problem of the genital mutilation. It's a very difficult subject to raise, I guess, for any leader in front of an audience containing women. But in Egypt, the numbers of people who have had this appalling thing happen to them, women, are up in the 90%. So this is a form of violence, really, against women, which has been condemned by the United Nations and so on. And yet this isn't mentioned as a factor. And instead of, I can understand why he didn't want to tackle that one head on, because who would? But instead, he sort of tried to give the impression that, women, there are issues of oppression for women in the Muslim world, but there are also issues of pressure of oppression of women in the Western world. And this creates a completely, I would have thought, dishonest sort of pitching of the issues, which fundamentally gives comfort to the much more conservative end of the spectrum over there. I think that part of the speech was just really especially sort of weak, really. No getting away from it.
And all the more striking because, of course, his base here in the United States includes a considerable number of feminists and other women who backed him in his presidential bid and who I'm endlessly struck seem to be silent as this kind of romancing of people who engage in misogyny, as the fancy word for it, sort of women hatred, are being empowered in places like Egypt. And of course, Mr. Messer, as you know, it's not just Egypt that we're seeing this phenomenon of rising Islamism. And again, having served in the former Yugoslavia in a number of different capacities and seen firsthand what I really regarded as a fairly assimilated, moderate Muslim population, radicalized and brutalized, it really, I must assume, is troubling to you to watch this playing out in a sort of similar fashion in parts of the Middle East, where, as you say, we haven't done a very good job of helping bring it to a more modern state.
Well, the Bosnian Muslim story is one for another interview, probably. It's so sort of complex in itself. But I think the issue of women in the Middle East is irreparably tangled up in the way Islam looks at the world. And when I say it's the Middle East, you get the same issues in London these days in certain sort of communities. So, we're importing some of these ideas into our own societies. And where perhaps the speech really didn't, to me, do the business. It was a very long speech, and he could have cut out an awful lot of stuff, but maybe what he could have put in was something about the debate within the Islamic world itself about reform and modernization, and that whole issue about how Islam changes and, which tendencies you support and which things need to change really wasn't there at all. And I would have thought there must have been somewhere like Cairo, which is a very, as the Arab world goes, a pretty dynamic and large, lively center, there must have been people there who would have been interested in what he had to say about that.
But he didn't want to get into it, I'm afraid, because he was actually not so keen on rousing the ire of the Muslim Brotherhood. We have to leave it at that. Mr. Ambassador, I do hope you'll come back to us to talk both about Bosnia and about what's happening in London on this score, and indeed about this new royal baby that is imminent as we speak. Thank you very much for your service, sir, and for spending a little time with us, and for this terrific piece at Punditwire. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, Gordon Chang joins us. We'll be talking about Abe's parliamentary win and what it might mean both for the Japanese and for us. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaevs' kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined as we are each week by Gordon Chang, our duty expert on what is going on in Asia and what it might mean for all of us, as well as the people in the region. He writes brilliantly for Forbes.com and World Affairs Journal. He is also a frequent guest on FoxNews.com and Fox News Network. He is also the author of two very important books, one about the coming collapse of China and the other about North Korea taking on the world. Gordon, let's talk first about what is happening in Japan. There was an election in the upper house of parliament there that seemed to have come out rather swimmingly for the prime minister, Mr. Abe. What does it mean that there was such a return, and
particularly beyond the domestic and economic issues for Japanese foreign policy at the moment?
The capture of the upper house by Shinzo Abe's Liberal Democratic Party and his coalition partners is important because it gives Abe the opportunity to strengthen Japan's defense. He's moving in that direction already. This consolidates his political position. It allows him to do what he wants. And what he wants to do is what the Japanese people want, which is to put more teeth into Japan's self-defense forces. This is a very good development because Japan has been challenged by China in recent years, and those challenges are only going to get worse as we see more and more problems in China itself.
We were talking last week with Bill Gertz, Gordon, about some of the intensifying posturing of both the Chinese and the Russians in connection with the somewhat pivoting behavior of the United States as it engages in military exercises with both the Japanese and the Indonesians. This presumably is only heightening the sense of concern on the part of the Japanese people, and presumably was reflected in part, at least in this outcome at the polls.
The just-completed naval exercises between Russia and China were directed at Japan. These are the largest naval exercises that the People's Republic has engaged in with another country. And for the Japanese, this is important because some of these exercises took place very close to Japanese shores. The Japanese certainly took note of this. They're going to have to do more with their maritime self-defense forces. And the United States is going to have to understand that China is now trying to intrude on the waters of other nations. This is a very important development that we all have to react to.
Going back to the Abe victory, is there reason to believe that in part it signals a growing sense on the part of the Japanese that they're going to have to do more for themselves in terms of their defense, both in the conventional sense and perhaps in the nuclear sense? We've known, and we've discussed this many times, that Japan has, by most accounts at least, the option to go into a nuclear weapons program basically at no notice. Do you expect that's going to take place under Mr. Abe as the Japanese continue to face growing threats from the Chinese?
Well, there are clearly more voices in Japanese society that Japan should go nuclear. I don't think that they will get to that point within Shinzo Abe's term. The question is, what do they really think about the United States as a friend of Japan? If we are to show strong determination in defending the Japanese, then I don't think the Japanese will go nuclear. But if they are concerned about us as an ally, as many people in Japan are, then you were going to see erosion in support for the United States and more support for going nuclear. There is the nuclear allergy in Japan right now, which is a leftover of World War II, but we're starting to see attitudes change on this, and they could change in a tipping point moment if the United States is not prepared to defend Japan and communicate that effectively to Japanese public.
The Chinese have recently messed with us as well as signaling in an alarming way their intentions towards Japan. Presumably, the Japanese and others in the region are following closely what happens when, like the incident with the USS Impeccable, an intelligence collection ship operating in international waters, goes unchallenged effectively when the Chinese engage in that kind of interference.
This is not the first time that the Chinese have harassed the Impeccable in international waters. This occurred recently. It also occurred in March 2009 when the harassment was so serious that it actually constituted a direct attack on the U.S. because the Chinese tried to sever the towed sonar array off the Impeccable. The United States did not react in public to this, and that is a big mistake. This was March 2009. In April 2009, America's Chief of Naval Operations went to China with an American destroyer to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the founding of the Chinese Navy. That should not have occurred after the Chinese harassed not only the Impeccable the month before, but also the Victorious. The United States needs to have a much more determined response. And we have not had when they have harassed our ships in international waters. And I've got to remind everyone that both the Impeccable and the Victorious are unarmed ships.
Let me ask you finally about one other issue that caught my attention. The Financial Times reported that the former CIA director, General Michael Hayden, had said what has widely been known to be true, but he nonetheless came out and declared that Huawei, the telecommunications giant with close ties to the Chinese People's Liberation Army, has in fact been spying for China and using its infrastructure where it is able to install it in the West for that purpose. Was there anything new in this revelation or simply confirmation of a very worrying thing? And what either way does it mean for the practice of using Huawei products in Western telecommunication systems?
General Hayden's reporting was clear in that he made specific certain things that we've suspected all along. He told the Financial Times that Huawei was using its commercial relations with other telecom companies, finding information, and then transmitting that back to Chinese authorities. This is something which is really important, and it indicates that no company should be doing business with Huawei. This is really important. We should be drawing a bright line on this. And while we're at it, we should also add ZTE, also a Chinese company, to the list of companies that should not be done business with.
And Gordon Chang, you have, of course, followed these companies and their relationship with the Chinese government for a long time. There are those in the West who have bought basically the party line that there is, in fact, sort of a private sector character to these companies. But whether they are indeed as intimately associated from a corporate point of view with the Chinese government, particularly the People's Liberation Army, or whether they're simply acting as Chinese companies always do in the service of the state, it creates an obvious problem for those companies that would have these parts in their systems. And I guess one of the questions that I just have to ask you, Gordon, I know this has been bruited about at some length in U.S. government circles. And to what extent do you think this wake-up call that from General Hayden will have the effect of shutting down once and for all this kind of infusion of Trojan horses by the Chinese government in our system?
I'm going to be an optimist and say that General Hayden's comments will end this issue once and for all, and that countries, the United States, Australia, India, will stop using Huawei equipment. I think that this is something very specific. It is something, yes, that we suspected, but he made it very clear. And what he talked about is something that was completely unacceptable on the part of Huawei. So I believe that we will soon see absolute prohibitions on foreign telecom companies doing business with Huawei, as everyone understands what Huawei is. Yes, it might be a private company, but it's doing the bidding of the Chinese military and the Chinese intelligence services.
As you say, to put a fine point on it, General Hayden said, quote, "It is simply not acceptable for Huawei to be creating the backbone of the domestic telecommunications network in the United States, period," he said, a principle that he also said applied to U.S. allies. Gordon Chang, I think we have to leave it at that. Thank you very much for joining us. As always, your insights in these matters are deeply appreciated. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week and to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.